this. I got 6 hours and 8 chapters. So we won't be able to say all that we'd like. Acts chapter 21. There's quite a bit of what is taking place in these chapters that are kind of a repeat. Paul gives his testimony a couple of times, and there are some new points brought out, and so we'll mention those, but hopefully that will allow us to go a little bit more quickly. Now, here in chapter 21, Paul is soon going to arrive in Jerusalem. And this chapter begins recording the events that will occur there. And so it's showing him traveling in verses 1 and 2. And then it says in verse 4, "And finding disciples, we tarried there 7 days, who said to Paul through the Spirit that he should not go up to Jerusalem." I think this is another example of where God is stating his real intent and real desire for Paul. I think God fully understands what Paul's heart is, and there's no problem as far as God understanding Paul's heart. He says Paul's not really understanding God's heart on the matter. And there's things that we can be motivated to do out of our own love, our own great desire to see people saved and ministered to. And the enemy is able to take advantage of those things. He's able to bring false responsibilities, false burdens. The enemy is pretty successful with this from time to time. And I really think that this is the case here. I don't feel real comfortable saying that Paul is out of the will of God, but I think in a manner of speaking, he really is. And we need to realize that all men of God have from time to time missed the will of God. It just what happens. We're not so in tune with God. We know all things, understand all things, see all things clearly. There's a lot of things that we're looking at through a glass darkly, and we're not really sure where we're headed. And he's doing the best that he knows how to do, and he does what he feels like he has to do. And so God's able to work with that because his heart is basically right. But I think because his great love for his brethren, I think that caused his ears to be a little bit dull of hearing. I think that's what the case really is. If I found out later that Paul had done exactly what God wanted, I'd just say, well, I hope I evaluate the situation better next time. So I'm not saying absolutely as though I'm super dogmatic on it, but I do think that he's to a degree missing what God really wants. I think there was a better way to get to Rome. I don't think that the way through Jerusalem was the way that God really wanted it. But because his heart remains open to God, God's able to get him to Rome. God's able to fulfill his plan. And I take comfort in this because I feel like we're all in the same kind of a situation where there are certain things that God really wants to do in our lives, but we're not going to get there in the shortest, quickest way, necessarily. I think there's going to be a number of instances where we take the longest of all long routes, but yet because our heart continues to remain open to God and we're willing to keep seeking God, he's still able to get us there. I don't think we just go from point A to point B. We kind of go from point A to point D and down to point L and over to point Z, and then we kind of go visit O and P and Q, and then we're over to H and to I, and then we get to point B. That's kind of how it works from time to time. But because God loves us so much, he still gets us there. And because we keep open to God. I haven't gotten from point A to point B all that directly, time after time. I've seen a lot of the countryside. A lot of it was needless. I could have just read a book and it would have told me all that I needed to know about the countryside. I didn't need to see it firsthand. Spent a lot of time visiting things, so to speak, that I didn't need to visit. Well, that's pretty much the way we are. God loves us. God sees us through. I think God wants us to better use our time and better understand what's involved here, but he can still keep dealing with us because, for the most part, we're still open We still love him. We're still teachable. We are desirous for his plan to be accomplished. But we're not desiring it perfectly, and we're not open perfectly. But it's enough that God is able to still work. And that's a very comforting thing. Now, as he travels on here, it says in verse 8, "And the next day we that were of Paul's company departed and came unto Caesarea, and we entered into the house of Philip the evangelist, which was one of the seven, and abode with him. And the same man had four daughters, virgins, which did prophesy." Now, when it says that he was one of the seven, it means that he was one of the seven deacons. It identifies him with the seven original deacons. This is the same Philip that we see in chapter 6 and in chapter 8. I believe it's chapter 6, where they have the concern there about the widows, and they name Stephen and Philip and a number of others, seven total, to be deacons to deal more with the mundane things. And then we also see how Philip's ministry is expanded in Acts chapter 8. And this is that same Philip. And that's why he's described as one of the seven, so that we'll have identification as to who he is. Verse 9 shows us that he was a very good parent. It shows that in living out his life for God, he had been able to be a proper parental influence upon his children. And so he ends up having these four daughters that are ministering for God. And it's also significant that this is mentioned to show that women had a place in the New Covenant Church, in the New Testament Church. So it gives credit to Philip, as he was a good parent, and it also shows that women had a place in the church. If they had no place and their position was of no value, then God would not mention these four daughters. There's got to be a basic reason why they're mentioned. It isn't just to add some interest to the story. It shows that they had a place in the church. And when they're singled out like this, it shows that they had a significant place. Women have a very significant role in our church, and that's the way it should be. It's a role as determined by the moving of God's Spirit. It's not a role determined by women's lib and ERA and all sorts of other demonic things. It's determined by God, and it's a very important role. I'm glad we do not have an all-male church. I'm glad the ministry is not all male. I'm glad that there are females in the ministry, in the right places, and more coming to those right places. It adds a dimension to the move of God that would be sorely lacking without women in these positions. Well, we are very glad that you are here. Let me tell you, it's very, very important. And that's good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you have received what I've said, and I receive what you say. It's very, very important, extremely important. I'm glad we do not have monasteries and convents and all sorts of other idiotic, nonsensical, demonic things. I'm glad that we understand basically the roles and positions. And I'm not saying that we understand them fully, because we don't, but we are more and more able to move into what God has for us. It's a tremendous thing. And they're operating the spirituals in the church. And they were prophesying. I do not believe that they were prophets. When it said they prophesied, most then assume they're prophets. But I don't believe they're prophets. But they were exercising the gift of prophecy and probably other spiritual things in the church. All prophets prophesy. Not all who prophesy are prophets. It's a very kind of non-profound statement, but it states it very clearly. Just because somebody speaks in tongues doesn't mean they have the gift of tongues. Just because somebody prophesies doesn't make them a prophet. Just because somebody preaches a sermon doesn't make them a pastor. There's a lot more involved than just being able to do one singular aspect or a number of aspects of a fuller ministry. Just because a person can do these few things doesn't mean they're in this full-blown ministry or this fuller position. I don't think they were prophets. I don't think they had women prophets. I don't think that's what the point is. They didn't have women pastors. They didn't have women that were involved in running the church. But they were still a very important part of the church. And the women were very much satisfied and fulfilled by the role that they were able to occupy. All the women in our church, I know they're very much satisfied with the roles that they're able to occupy. And they feel very much fulfilled, very much satisfied. They're not living under all sorts of frustration because they don't get to be Bible college teachers and then be able to do this and have this role and be elders. And they don't feel that way. Now, there's some who come in and feel that way. Those are the ones that need deliverance. They need Bible college, and they need to be around here for a while and get free of these lies. And it's not to say that God won't use women in some of these capacities when the need is there. He has, and he will undoubtedly still have to do that from time to time. But it really is not what God wants to do. Catherine Kuhlman admitted over and over again she knew that she was not the one God wanted in that ministry. She knew that there were men that did not say yes to God. She knew that. She knew that. She knew it by the Spirit. But she was the only one who would say yes, and so God finally had to tap her. That's an indictment. It's a real indictment against men of God. And they were men of God, but the devil somehow got them bound up, and they wouldn't say yes. They wouldn't put down their own ministry or their own ideas or whatever, and so God found somebody who would finally say yes. It happened to be a woman, and she did a tremendous job in yielding to God, and God used her in a very profound way. But it wasn't really the will of God. It wasn't what God really wanted to do. And that doesn't belittle the woman or demean the woman at all. So he created her for certain purposes that would really fulfill her and satisfy her. And a position that, like Catherine Kuhlman was in, that didn't really fulfill her. I know that that was a very heavy weight and burden for her. Now, she found the way to operate it with God's Spirit, but I don't think she was able to bear up as well with that ministry as a man would have. A man who would have been yielding to God, I think, overall would have done much better than what she did. But she did a very good job under the circumstances. And so God did use her. But that does not now prove this is God's will, this is how God wants to do it. Some churches where the pastor's died, the pastor's wife has taken over. Well, I think that's appropriate for a time.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think, and I think some have unwittingly been trapped where they have continued to hold that position, and I don't think that that's what they should have done. They should have kept believing God to raise up another pastor for that congregation so that they once again could take more of a help-type position. And but under the circumstances, they did what they knew to do as best as they could. So that's what they did. And I'm not going to fault them, and I'm surely not going to judge them for it. But I think there is probably a better way. I think that's what we're dealing here with Paul. There's a better way to get to Rome, but he was going to take this route instead. Now, they keep expressing their heart to him. Verses 10 to 14, Agabus comes, the prophet Agabus. We already saw him in chapter 11, verses 27 and 28. And he takes Paul's girdle, ties it around his own hands, and says, this is the way, this is what's going to happen to you in Jerusalem. He says, so shall the Jews at Jerusalem bind the man that owneth this girdle and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles. And all these people, they sorrowed over this. And Paul answers in verse 13, what mean ye to weep and to break mine heart? Literally, to crush mine heart to pieces. Their reaction was making it all the harder for him to leave, as he feels he must before God. I think that his love was hindering his mind from really seeing this thing as God wanted him to. But because his heart's pure and his love is pure, in a manner of speaking, it's not pure like it should have been. He should have given this love that he felt for the Jews over to God and then said, now, Lord, you give it back to me in a way that it really reflects how you see it and so that I'll be doing what you want me to do. But as far as a genuine love, he had a genuine love for these people, and he was deeply concerned for them. And I think that made it difficult for him to really hear what God was saying. And he would not be persuaded, and so we ceased, saying, the will of the Lord be done. When it says, the will of the Lord be done, there in verse 14, it does not mean necessarily that they now accepted Paul's view as being God's will. It shows them simply placing the entire matter over to Jesus. They just placed it in his hands, placing it They're in the hands of God. If we were ministering to somebody like this and they felt like they really had to do something, and no matter what we said, we couldn't convince them, and there's no way that we can show from clear text of Scripture that they're walking down a pathway of sin, we would just finally have to say, well, we'll just pray that the will of the Lord will be done. And what we're saying, in effect, is we're giving the whole thing over to God. And we don't really know what the Lord's going to be able to do with this, but we now accept what your heart is, and we accept what your decision is, and so now we just turn the matter over to God. That's what they're saying. It doesn't say that they've been convinced by Paul, and now Paul has really been able to show them that he was right, and he knew God's will. That's how it's being stated. So they continue on, and then in verse 18, they've come to Jerusalem, and it says at the end of verse 17, and the brethren received us gladly. And the day following, Paul went in with us unto James, and all the elders were present. Now, it's very interesting that it doesn't mention the apostles. And the term elders does not refer to the apostles. The apostles are not mentioned. It just has James and the elders. So it begs the question, where are the apostles? Well, we know as the church began, the apostles were used in a very vital role as church administrators. The people didn't know a whole lot, and so the apostles, they were responsible for 99.9% of everything that was done. And they had to run the whole show right there in Jerusalem. And we see this in Acts chapter 4. But then the other kind of needs, physical, mundane, more, in a sense, non-spiritual needs began to pile up. And so the apostles were forced to delegate part of the ministry, the parts of the ministry that others could handle. And this is exactly what we will experience in various positions, pastoral positions or whatever. And we'll start to recognize that after a period of time where we have done just about everything, and I think almost all of us will probably experience this in different kinds of ministries, different kinds of situations, start to realize that it's too much, and we're going to have to start delegating certain things. You delegate the things that other people can do. You keep the things that only you can do. And so as far as waiting on the tables, in a certain manner of speaking, anybody can do that. But as far as the other things that were more spiritual, more complicated, more detailed, more of a vital nature spiritually regarding the whole move of God, the apostles continued to do those things themselves. And so that's what we see in Acts chapter 6. Now, when the problem with legalism arose with the Judaizers in Acts 15 and verse 4, we see the apostles and elders deal with the problem. That's what 15:4 says. I'll read that. And when they were come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and elders, and they declared all things that God had done with them. So it mentions the apostles and elders as two categories. Now, of course, the apostles are part of the eldership there, but not all elders were apostles. All apostles are elders, but not all of the elders are in apostolic ministry. So there's two categories. But now, here in chapter 21, we don't see them. And I think the reason is very, very simple. I think it's because they're out preaching and establishing churches elsewhere. And the church there in Jerusalem is no longer their direct responsibility. I think at first, the direct responsibility for the new church was in the lap of the 12 apostles. But once the church was really established with an actual pastor, James, the half-brother of Christ, and then elders were established, those that proved faithful in the ministry, now the apostles were free to be the sent out ones. And they were free to establish other churches and to be out preaching elsewhere. And I think we're going to see things like this in our own church, where people right now that are in more important, more vital roles in a certain sense, they're not free to be doing a lot of other things because there's not anybody else really that can take their place. But as God will raise up others to take their place, then they'll be free to do other things. And I know Mark Yokers, just as an example, his heart is to be a pastor. And it may involve apostolic ministry, it may involve evangelism, it may involve all sorts of things. His heart is not just to continue to be a Bible college teacher. But as much as it might seem to some that a Bible college teacher is just have notebook, will travel, it's not quite that easy. And there's really not that many people that could take his place. And you can't just send him out and then have people have to prepare all of his classes. It's one thing just to prepare them. That's another thing to teach them.
Right.
And then to teach them effectively. And it's not an overnight thing. It's anything but easy. And so, at this point, since there aren't really others that can just actually move right in and take his place, he can't do further things that I think God really has in mind for him. And that might be true with quite a number of others in our church, and I'm sure that it is. It's quite a task to prepare even one class, let alone all of a sudden have, say, about 10 hours of class put in your lap. It'd be quite a difficult thing. So just to bring in new teachers, and just because they did well academically, there's a lot more that goes into it. And from time to time, lists are sent around to the teachers and elders regarding who might be good for certain ministries, who might be equipped to be teachers and other such things. And we have a lot of names to choose from, but overall there's a lot of question marks. And that's true with all of us, no matter what position we're in, there's always question marks. But it can seem like there's a lot of people, but then when it gets right down to, well, now how are they doing in their marriage? How are they really doing with other spiritual pursuits? How are they doing with their job? How about this? What about these kind of areas? There's not as many people as it might look like. See, people from time to time seem to lose the vision, and instead of continuing to really labor sight unseen with their future ministry, they just kind of get a little weary and well-doing and find an oak tree and sit down under it, and that's when some lions come and visit. It's not a very safe thing to do. So now the apostles are freed up, and they're able to go out ministering. Well, I think that applies to some people here as well. So that's just some food for thought, get you to think more and commit more. The more that we prepare, see, like Russ McKenzie, just as an example, he prepared a number of Bible college class notebooks before he ever started teaching in Bible college. He already had a full notebook on the unfolding revelation of God, Bible authenticity, and I think a couple of others. See, now that brother had a vision. That brother wasn't waiting for somebody to put a badge on him and give him a title. He was doing what he felt the Spirit of God wooing him to do. And so then, now with somebody like that, you can tap him on the shoulder just about any old time and he's ready. But a lot of other people, you tap him on the shoulder and everything's in disarray. We need to make sure that we're doing as best as we know what God is really asking us to do, getting as prepared as possible for these things. They're coming. There's all sorts of ministerial possibilities, and so we need to open our eyes and see that and just keep preparing. Just keep preparing. Just keep putting the shovel into the earth. Just keep digging the ditches. Keep doing these things. Keep collecting the vessels. Keep doing these things. Just keep believing God. Keep using that one talent. Keep doing it. Keep doing it. It's building something. And I think we'll be amazed at what is really being built, what is really being accomplished. Now in verse 20, Paul tells about what has been going on with the Gentiles. And it says, when they heard it, they glorified the Lord and said unto him, thou seest, brother, how many thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous of the law. Now, the reaction to what Paul says, as far as what's taking place with the Gentiles, that the church basically rejoices. But here in Jerusalem, there is a growing misunderstanding. And right away they talk about the many thousands of Jews. And literally it just means it's myriads of Jews, which a lot of times is translated tens of thousands. But literally it's just the word myriads, which is no actual number figure. It means whole bunch. Yeah, gobs. You know, all of those real definitive words of definition. And it possibly refers to Jewish believers that are gathered in the city for the feast. This is the Feast of Pentecost, chapter 20, verse 16. And so it can be Jewish Christians from elsewhere, as well as from Jerusalem itself. I don't think that the point he's making is that there's just a lot of Jews here. That's pretty obvious. It's the time of a major feast, city of Jerusalem, so that's obvious. These Jews that he's talking about must be of a particular category. He's talking about believers, those that are born again. But, see, there was a problem. They were still zealous of certain aspects of the law, though they had accepted Jesus as Messiah. Verse 21, it says, "And they are informed of thee, that thou teachest all the Jews which are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, saying that they ought not to circumcise their children, neither to walk after the customs." F.F. Bruce, in his commentary on Acts, he says, "But there was something that caused them serious anxiety, and now they had an opportunity of unburdening their minds to Paul about it. It was freely rumored among the Jewish Christians of Jerusalem that Paul not only refused to impose the requirements of the Jewish law on his Gentile converts," that is, in the eyes of many, bad enough, despite the decision taken at the Council of Jerusalem, "but he actually dissuaded Jewish believers, it was said, from continuing to practice their ancestral customs handed down from Moses." So there's a lot of rumors. A lot of rumors. "He even encouraged them to give up circumcising their sons." See, this is what's being said about Paul. "James and the elders apparently regarded these rumors as false, and indeed there is no evidence for their truth. But it would take more than a verbal assurance to convince the myriad zealots for the law in the Jerusalem church that they had been misinformed." A lot of misinformed people, aren't there? Mm-hmm. "There were slanderous accusations. They were aimed by the devil to hurt Paul's ministry." This was an attack of the devil. Through who? Christians. Very normal, unfortunately. It should be abnormal, but it ends up being quite normal. You can note chapter 16, verses 1 to 4, as well as chapter 18, verse 18, which shows Paul being very balanced in how he'll use the law, how he views the law. Paul was not doing what these things are saying, what these accusations amount to. He's not doing that. He's not telling them to leave their customs. He's not telling them to stop being Jews. He wasn't telling them to stop getting circumcised. He wasn't telling them that. Few things cripple the effectiveness of the ministry more than false information passed on by gossips. Just ask Merv Widener. Ask Dan O'Brien. Just ask them. Ask them what it's like to have false information passed around by gossips. It blows churches apart. And it's a dangerous thing. It's been the major difficulty that Dan has had in Yakima. Boy, time after time, he's got people in, and then before you know it, they're gone. Somebody got to him. Somebody harangued in their ear, and the people just... think. They don't evaluate. They don't take time to consider things. They just believe it. They just haul up and believe it. Don't even check it out. If people checked out all the things they've heard about Community Chapel, they would be so convinced so quickly of the idiotic nature and demonic nature of these lies They'd wake up to what's going on, but they won't check it out. They just believe it. And that's the way people are, and that's the way Christians are. They don't think deep. They don't evaluate. Hear something, and they just glom right onto it. We got to be different than that. We got to be a different kind of people. We got to be people of integrity. That's not integrity. Checking things out carefully, that's integrity. That's being honest. Making sure that this information is factual. People won't even take time to make sure that something's factual. And they don't care. They got spirits. That's why they buy all those absurd magazines at the supermarket. National Enquirer and all these big splashy headlines. It's enough to make you sick. Mm-hmm. And people believe it and they like it. It's tantalizing. Tickles their ears. They enjoy that. Well, a lot of Christians have those same spirits. Now, see, as far as the customs, he wasn't teaching the Jews to stop being Jewish. I mean, they're Jewish. And they have basic customs and a basic way of life. He wasn't telling them to stop being that. The real problem seems to be that they didn't know where to maintain Judaism and where to leave off from Judaism. And you know the devil's involved, and this is quite a dilemma. People have this same problem when they're leaving the Catholic Church, leaving the Lutheran Church, leaving certain Pentecostal churches. You know, should I stay in the church? How many services should I attend? Should I do this? Should I say this? Should I let my pastor know this? Is he still really my pastor? A lot of Christians face the same dilemma. They don't know where to leave off with Lutheranism, Presbyterianism. They don't know where to leave off. They don't know where to keep attached to certain things and break off from others. They don't know what to do with Christmas. A lot of people here at Community Chapel still don't know what to do with Christmas. They don't know what to do with different situations regarding unclean meats. They don't know what to do with Easter. They don't know what to do with all these different kind of things in the store, different kind of Cabbage Patch dolls, Care Bears. They don't think. They don't evaluate. They don't look in to try to find out, now, where are these things coming from? They let their kids embrace every new fad. Unbelievable, the things that go on. People have to be a lot more careful with life. And then when they embrace something, then they blast everybody else who doesn't embrace it. Boy, we got to get this thing straight.
That's right.
If we make a commitment, that's our commitment.
Yeah.
And we don't have any right to go around and foist that off on anybody else. This is what Don's talking about. As far as the imbalanced quackery, and it passes through our assembly, somebody reads a book, and they're going to pass that book around our whole church. We got to think. We've got to realize what they're doing. You find something interesting, well, don't be so sure that it's all that interesting. And don't be so sure that it's all that accurate. Amazing how many people find something, they think it's accurate, and they give it to somebody else, and they just tear it to shreds. Because this person got his head screwed on straight, is able to see through some of the things. It's amazing how something that looks so good, when you get all done with it, it's not so good at all. You got to be real careful. So they had big problems, just a big problem. Talking about thousands of Jews, the rumors are rampant. Paul's got a dynamic ministry. Can you imagine the rumors against Jimmy Swaggart? Can you imagine the rumors against David Wilkerson? We can't even imagine the rumors against us. We don't really realize what's going on out there. If we knew all the things that have been said, we'd shake our heads and just so utter unbelief. We'd be so just utterly overwhelmed and amazed. They're unbelievable things. How can anybody say we're sacrificing chickens in our back prayer area? How can anybody say such a thing? Chicken's never been in our church. Never had a chicken in there. I mean, how can anybody say something like that? That isn't dumb. I don't know what is dumb. But how can anybody believe it? It's what they want to believe. They get duped. They get deceived. It's a terrible situation. So here's James and the elders, and they're trying to do something to properly handle this thing. This is a real dilemma. Well, I'm glad I wasn't part of this church government. I'm glad I wasn't one of the senior elders that had to deal with this thing, you know, in a manner of speaking. This is not easy. And then you got the armchair quarterback who's going to criticize anything they try to do. I got somebody who's going to open his big yap and say something when he should put his hand in the nearest hole and bury it, stuff his mouth with tissue paper or something. You got to be real careful with these things. Not easy situation. This is a hard situation. So they say, what is it there for? The multitude must needs come together, for they will hear that thou art come. Kenneth Weiss translates it, what is it there for? They will certainly hear that you have come and are here. They're going to know you're here. And they're going to want to know what we're doing about you. So we got to do something. So here's what we propose. A certain plan is adopted. We have four men which have a vow on them. So they adopt a certain plan. And Paul was to associate himself with four men that were taking a vow based on Jewish law. And this would be a confirmation to Jewish Christians that he had not forsaken Moses. And I don't care how strange this sounds, we've got to understand that we're still in a transition period, and we're not able just to push the reject and eject button of Judaism and it's just all gone. And now everybody gets to start from square one and have none of the past and none of their demons, and everything just starts out brand new. It doesn't start that way. They get saved and they bring a whole horde of demons with them and a lot of confused ideas. What have they been taught? They've been taught what's in the synagogue. That doesn't just fall off like that. It just doesn't happen. And then the devil is still there, further taking advantage. So here we got this dilemma, this problem. They say, well, we got four men, four good men. People know them, and they're under this vow. They felt to make this vow before God. And part of it is they're still looking for inroads to minister to the Jews. They're trying to find a common ground where they can do things that still gives them an avenue to witness. They don't want to just separate themselves totally from Judaism. They don't want to do that. They want to find a way to still win these souls. And I'm not saying that that was right. I don't really know. I'm not saying that what James suggested was right, absolutely, or the way they were doing things was right. I don't know. I don't know, absolutely. But this is what they did. This is the best they knew how to do. And sometimes that's all we can do. We don't have anything else available to us. So he says, them take and purify thyself with them and be at charges with them. This phrase, be at charges, means that Paul was to help pay the expenses of the vow. And there were certain offerings which would be made at the conclusion of the days of purification. That's mentioned in verse 6. And so there are certain payments that had to be made as far as buying the animals. And now, it's not some sort of a vow that has to do with salvation and has to do with really coming closer to God. I find it very perplexing. I don't have an absolute explanation, but there was still this connection between Jewish Christians and the law, and they had not been able to fully divorce themselves from the law, and probably because they're still looking for ways to witness to the people, and they don't want to just cut themselves off from all the people. That's basically going to happen soon enough as it is. I think the same thing happens right now with Jews that get saved today. Boy, they just end up being married to so many of the traditions of present-day Jews for such a long time that all the Christians that go over to Israel to be part of the different feasts over there and singing Jewish songs, and it's really a phenomenal thing. Maybe some of you aren't even aware of how much of this goes on, but it goes on with thousands upon thousands of Gentile Christians. Not just Jewish Christians, but Gentiles, non-Jewish Christians. And they'll go over, I mean, the trips to the Holy Land, they're happening all the time. Thousands upon thousands of people are going there, but a lot of them are going there to be part of the feast days and to try to find some sort of a way to let the Jews know that we're for them. And this idea that they're God's chosen people today is a very prevalent thought amongst a lot of people, which is not what the Bible teaches. They're no more the chosen people than sinners down in the ghetto and down in the slums and in the tavern. They're just sinners, ranked sinners like everybody else. But a lot of confusion on that. So if we've got all this kind of confusion today, and people are doing all these kind of muddled things and confused things right now, well, you know there was confusion back then. They were just coming out of Judaism. How far did Luther come out of the Catholic Church? About one step. About one step. It's not easy to come out of these things. It's not just an overnight, instantaneous, absolute step out, totally free. How quickly have we stepped out of the world? We still got quite a number of attachments. We got more than just our little pinkies in there sometimes. Our little teeny toes is not the only thing that's still attached there. There's a few other things sometimes, a few other things that still have us kind of bound up. Certain things have us trapped. People come in here and they take unfolding revelation of God, but they still battle for a long time trying to really get free of the doctrine of three persons in the Godhead. And there's people who come in, you teach them all about speaking in tongues, baptism of the Holy Spirit. They're filled with the Holy Spirit and speaking in tongues, and they still can't see the tongues are the only sign. And there's all sorts of things that are problems and difficulties, not easy to see, not quick to see. And so really, overall, it's not some ancient day problem, does not exist anymore. It's really quite common even now. And as a pastor, you're in a position where you have to deal with certain things and find a way to establish common ground, and it's not easy. It's not easy at all. So this is what James and the elders there are trying to do, is trying to find a way to assure the people that Paul is not against the Jews. He's for the Jews. He's trying to minister to the Jews. He's trying to help the Jews. So I think that, see, at first, it looks like Christianity is anti-Jewish. That's how it comes across, anti-Jewish. So the Jews are going to bend over backwards, the Christian Jews, to try to let these other Jews know, we're not against you, we're for you. So that's also part of what's happening here. And it makes it difficult. It's not easy. We need to give some thought to it sometimes as to how we go about witnessing to people. And there are certain areas where you can do a lot more with certain people than kind of what legalism would let us do. Sometimes we make the areas where we can have contact with people too rigid. Now, some people, it's too broad, but others, too rigid. And so then there's never any common ground to really get into the heart of some unsaved person. No common ground to get in the hearts of our relatives. So it's not easy. It's not easy at all. It's very difficult. So this is the kind of situation that's going on. And so Paul says, fine, I'll go ahead and do it. That's what we see in verse 26. And Paul took the men the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification. And so Paul says, okay. He's very conciliatory in this thing. Now, what this is, number one, it's consistent with the principles of doing all to keep our brethren from stumbling. I think that's the main consideration. He says, okay, I'm not so sure that Paul really agreed with this, but I think he says, if that's what you want me to do, I'll just submit. If you feel that this will help, I'm going to trust your judgment. I don't think it's something that he really took a lot of time to evaluate, pray about. I think he just said, okay, I'll do it. If you think this will help. And he may not have really felt like it would help that much. We don't know what's going through his mind. He may have felt like, well, this isn't really the best way to do it, but if this is what you think, and this is how you want me to do it, and I love you, and you love me, and we all love the Jewish Christians as well as the unsaved Jews, okay, I'll do this. And I think it also follows the principle of doing all that we can do to keep the doors open for the gospel without really compromising. Now, part of the difficulty right there is the definition of compromising. So some people would say he did compromise. Others will say he didn't compromise. And the majority of people say, well, I don't really know. And I think sometimes that's more the category we're in. We don't really know necessarily. I don't think this was compromising. And even if it was, it's still just the best they knew how to do under the circumstances. And if God later convicts them that they were compromising, then they would repent of it. But it's he's just giving us history of what they did. It's interesting to see what they did under these circumstances. They're just doing the best they know how. So James and the elders feel that it's best. Paul submits, doesn't argue. They all see it for the furthering of the gospel and for dispelling hurtful slander. And we just have to keep in mind how difficult the transition time is here from moving from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And especially when we consider the spiritual state of the Jews at the time of Christ, they were so absolutely confused. See, if they had all been where they could have been spiritually and Jesus came, this transition would be totally different. But Jesus comes, they want to kill him. And if they could have killed God, that's who they would have killed. And all of their laws are anti-God, really. Their legalism is setting them against God. Really, total opposition to God. And so then for them to get saved isn't going to be just a huge, total, instantaneous flip-flop. And now here they are, 100% transformed. It just doesn't work that way. It doesn't work right now that way. One trip to the altar doesn't do it. We've taken a lot more than one trip. And it hasn't been total, 100% absolute transformation. Hasn't been just one deliverance session and now all things are clear, got all things in order, all priorities straight. It just doesn't quite work that way. This is not a compromise of the doctrine of salvation. And so he would not, and they would not ask him to do something that could be interpreted as part of the way to get saved. This is something completely separate from that. It's just mainly to show I'm still for you. And I don't just throw your law out the window, and I'm not telling you to just throw your customs out the window. It's an issue separate from the issue of salvation. It has to be. Otherwise, it would be a compromise. And it would really be a point of great confusion. So it has to be separate from the issue of salvation. Now, what happens next, though, is that Jews which were from Asia, this is verse 27, here we have those Jews from Asia again. Remember the Jews in Ephesus? Well, it's these kind of people, Asia, the province of Asia Minor. They see him in the temple. Paul's pretty well known. And so they stir up the people. The Greek for stirred up means to confound or to throw into confusion. They start making all sorts of accusations, and it actually confuses the people. They don't know what to think. So how do they react? You know how most people react when their mind is in a state of confusion and you get them worked up? They react violently. So that's what they do here. They react violently. And they say that Paul brought a Gentile into the temple. And that's because of verse 29. For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus and an Ephesian. And they thought that Paul had brought this man into the temple. This man's mentioned in chapter 20 and verse 4. Chapter 20 and verse 4 mentions Trophimus. So they dragged Paul out of the court of Israel and into the courts of the Gentiles. And verse 30 says they immediately shut the doors. There were doors, that is, gates, that were between these different courts. And the inner court is the court of Israel, where the Jews could go, and then they had outer courts. Courts for Gentiles, courts for women, a lot of different areas. And there are walls between these courts and then gates. And so they drag him out of the court of Israel and into the court of the Gentiles, and they close the gates. And it's done probably to prevent further rioting within the sacred areas of the temple. This isn't counted as much of a sacred area because it's the area for the Gentiles. And it's also done probably because the Jews don't want to defile any of more of the proper area of the temple with Paul's blood. And this riot is leading to a point of where Paul's life is immediately in danger. And so it causes quite an uproar. And then in verses 31 and 32, and they went about to kill him, but tidings came. Somebody probably comes immediately up to this chief captain of the band, and this is showing that he was overseeing a group of soldiers, upwards of 1,000 in number. And it comes to him and says that Jerusalem is in an uproar. Literally, it says Jerusalem was being confused. So it just further emphasizes this, the confusion about this whole state of affairs. And he immediately takes soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. So they were beating him up. And they took Paul immediately and put him in two chains. And they assumed that he must be a very dangerous person. And we see this in verse 38. He thinks that Paul is this particular Egyptian who had caused riots before. And when he finds out that he isn't, he's rather amazed about this whole thing. Now, verse 37 is kind of a perplexing verse, where it says, and as Paul was to be led into the castle, the word castle means barracks. It's also used in verse 34, just the soldier's barracks. He said unto the chief captain, may I speak unto thee? And then the captain responds and says, who said? Canst thou speak Greek? Now, the who is the captain. He's talking to the captain, may I speak unto thee? Who said? That's not part of the question. Who said? The captain said, canst thou speak Greek? Sometimes the way these things are stated in the King James takes about 20 minutes just to figure out who's talking. And not so much what's being said, but just who's talking. Kind of, that's why you want to use New American Standard or Kenneth Wiest or Rotherham and read that along with it. And he's surprised that this Jew is speaking Greek. Well, I don't know why he is surprised. That's kind of perplexing. He may just be ignorant that the Jews are a multilingual people. But that seems kind of far-fetched. It would seem like everybody knew that. But he may be new there in Jerusalem. He may not have been aware that they were a multilingual people. Or maybe it has something to do with him thinking that this was an Egyptian. Art not thou that Egyptian, which before these days madest an uproar? And so, because he thinks he's an Egyptian Jew, he may not be aware that that he could speak Greek. It's kind of a perplexing thing. Maybe it's the way that he spoke the Greek. Maybe it was more the Attic Greek. Maybe it was more the intellectual, literary style of Greek. But we really don't know. But for some reason, this soldier was amazed that he could speak Greek, and that caused him to think, well, then, I thought you were this Egyptian. And somehow it caused him to realize, well, maybe you're not this man. But see, we don't know the history of all of it. And we surely don't know what's going on in this man's mind. And so there was this Egyptian Jew who had caused all sorts of an uproar, and was involved with all sorts of assassinations and riots, and so he thinks that this is the man that he's captured here. And then Paul said, I am a man, which am a Jew, of Tarsus, a city of Cilicia, a citizen of no mean city. And of no mean city means of no undistinguished reputation. It was a very distinguished city. And he's claiming to have Roman citizenship, but the soldier doesn't catch the point. Notice chapter 22, verses 24 to 27. So he's actually claiming to be a Roman citizen, but the soldier in charge here doesn't catch that point. We'll see that later on. And then he asks if he can speak to the people, and there's a great silence, and he spoke to them in Hebrew. He spoke to them in Aramaic. And so he seizes this long-awaited opportunity for public testimony, and he speaks in Aramaic, and that's what Hebrew means. And, you know, there's just things here that are hard to piece together as to why certain things are so significant. See, in the next chapter, he addresses them. My men, brethren, and fathers, hear ye my defense, which I make now unto you. And when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept the more silence, and he saith. Well, it's perplexing to me at least, maybe not to you, but it is to me, why, in him speaking Aramaic, does that really cause them to be all the more quiet? Aramaic is their national language. So, but for some reason, maybe because of the circumstances or because of who they think he is, for him to speak Aramaic, which was the national language of the Jews, somehow had an appeal to the people. And I know that if one was to go through all the commentaries and get all the different opinions, well, that's just about all we'd have. We'd have 10, 15, 20 different opinions, but we still don't have any absolute answers. Somehow, in Paul using the national language, it appealed more to their patriotic pride, and it caused them to listen attentively. Maybe in normal situations like this, maybe because you have such a mixed multitude of people, maybe normally in a more of a public type gathering, maybe they'd use Koine Greek. Maybe that's more what the case would have been, because that's the universal language of the day. And since these people are from all different parts of the known world at the time, maybe normally in a gathering like this, somebody speaking publicly would have spoken Greek. Maybe that's what explains it. But again, all we can do is guess at that. But nevertheless, through these events, which are, you can know they're hard on Paul. There's a lot of stress. The enemy's attacking. He's able to address his people. And verse 3, he's trying to show them when he says, I am verily a man which am a Jew born in Tarsus and so forth. He's trying to show them that his early experiences have been basically like theirs. So again, he's trying to establish a common ground. And then he's going to go on and try to testify them to them about his salvation. It works out pretty well until he mentions the Gentiles. And once he mentions the Gentiles, kaboom! That's the end of his testimony. And we'll see that next time. Very explosive situation. But God is honoring Paul's heart and Paul's commitment. And God's going to get him to Rome.